the so-called godfather of Lagos to Nigeria's president-elect. We'll look at Bola Tinubu's election victory in Nigeria. His supporters are celebrating. His opponents want fresh elections. What comes next for the West African nation? We'll have reporting and analysis. Also, as Russia's war in Ukraine rages into a second year, are there signs of war fatigue in the West? Mark Mallock Brown speaks to me about the mood among world leaders at the recent Munich Security Conference. Straight Talk Africa starts now.
Hello there and welcome. I'm Heidi Adams, coming to you from VOA's headquarters in Washington. There is mixed reaction in Nigeria to the news that the ruling party's Bola Tinubu will be the country's next president. Nigeria's Electoral Commission declared Tinubu the winner of Saturday's polls. Official results show he won 37% of the vote. Even as his supporters celebrate, the 70-year-old president-elect is calling for unity. Opposition parties are calling for fresh elections. They claim this one was rigged. Let's go to Nigeria now. Timothy Obiezu is in the capital, Abuja, for us with more.
Having satisfied the requirements of the law, is hereby declared the winner.
Bola Tinubu, declared Nigeria's president-elect by the Electoral Commission, INEC, early Wednesday. But opposition candidates are calling the election a sham and are demanding a revote. 10 political party agents walked off the Results Collation Center this week in the capital, including Dino Melaye of the People's Democratic Party.
We have records of where elections did not take place and results have been prepared.
Tinubu, 70, is a former governor of Nigeria's economic capital, Lagos, who is often called a political godfather. He says his election was credible and commends INEC. But a few kilometers away from the venue of the national collation, protesters gather. They say the people's will was subverted and thousands of voters suppressed, thwarting chances of their preferred candidate, Peter Obi. Experts predicted the Labour Party contender would benefit most from zealous young voters who accounted for more than 80% of the total 10 million new voters.
INEC is a fraud, and what we are saying is that because INEC has accepted the fraudulent result, we have just one thing. We have passed a vote of no confidence on INEC and the team.
But just across the road, supporters of Tinubu and the ruling party also converged.
I witnessed people who walked 2 kilometers, 3 kilometers to their polling booth. Now, at the end of the day, someone is now saying, cancel this election. It is not done anywhere.
The presidential election was considered the most crucial vote in Nigeria since 1999, but the process was marred by staff delays at voting centers, technical difficulties with voting machines, and violence. There were also allegations of deliberate manipulations. At one polling unit in Abuja, voters said while they waited for hours to cast their ballot, an official was thumbprinting on the ballot behind closed doors.
I think in that moment, it just felt like hope was shattering before my very face. Like they were taking hope away from me. And I believe that that's the same way that a lot of people felt.
INEC said it was aware of the obvious difficulties, but denies these challenges were deliberately created to disenfranchise the people or favor a particular candidate. But these words are hard to explain here, where many like John Gideon say they didn't get a chance to vote.
You want a better Nigeria? Enough is enough. We are tired. If they are not coming to our house, we die here, oh my God. Now we die here.
It is pathetic, it is saddening, it is wickedness, it is against our civic rights for INEC not to listen to us and come to our aid. Oh, we really know to vote. I want to vote. INEC, I want to vote.
None of the opposition parties have openly called for protests, but they are expected in the coming days to officially challenge the results in court.
Heidi, it's not clear what to expect in the coming days or weeks, but these people are visibly angry. Their mandates were taken from them. And what I do know about Nigerian youths is they're strong, They're powerful, they're sophisticated and influential. And when they coalesce for a cause, they can hold even the most powerful people accountable. We've seen this before.
Timothy, thank you. Now, for an in-depth discussion on the dynamics at play here and what comes next, I'm joined by Temi Ibirogba in Lagos. Temi is an analyst with the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. Also joining me from Abuja is Idayat Hassan. She's the director of the Center for Democracy and Development. Ladies, a warm welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you for having us.
Timmy, I'm going to start out with you here. Now, we've had a look earlier in the show at the political reaction to this, but you are in Lagos, that means you're in Lagos State. That is actually Bola Tinubu's home turf, although he didn't win that state this time. What has the reaction been like there? I mean, yes, there's disappointment, even outrage, but are people really surprised? Are you surprised?
Yes, like you said, Tinubu is the former governor of Lagos State with a stronghold, but Obi was still impressively able to, you know, win Lagos, despite the lack of credibility around the transmission of results. There was election violence, voter intimidation, suppression of polling units. But despite all of this, Obi was able to win. So, of course, among Tinubu loyalists and supporters, there's disappointment. But amongst the youth, there's a lot of excitement that Obi was able to win such a major state like Lagos.
Idayat, of course, there is celebration in Bola Tinubu's camp, but opposition parties are, of course, calling for fresh elections. They say this one was a sham. The electoral commissioner said, if you're unhappy, look, take it to court. But is there a world in which that could happen? And is it really a good idea for the opposition parties to be calling for fresh elections?
I think it's not a very good idea. It's actually because in elections in Nigeria, there is actually a time frame to conclude elections. If perchance they insist and there is this call for fresh elections, it might actually trigger a coup d'etat in a region of West Africa where we are seeing more and more coup d'etat, some emanating from disputed elections. Two, again, is that there is actually a time frame. By April 30th, that is the cutoff date to actually conduct fresh elections, requiring fresh preparation and maybe a fresh commission. It's more or less saying that let's invoke the doctrine of necessity and go for an interim national government. So it's not a good way to start, actually, especially now that there are new leeways. If there are problems with the result, they have within 7 days to approach the commission, the electoral commission, to review the report on results on one hand, while on the other hand, they have the opportunity to exploit the full limit of the law to ensure that they regain their mandate if stolen.
We'll come back to that a little later. Timmy, Mr. Tinubu is known, of course, as the so-called godfather of Lagos. He is known to be a smooth political operator. His supporters see him as an effective administrator, and he does wield tremendous political power. How can he and how likely is he to use that political capital to tackle Nigeria's wide range of problems here?
Well, he's definitely going to use his political power. We already saw him using it during the campaign season and during the elections itself. You know, in terms of actually getting the job done with insecurity, with Nigeria's struggling economy, with corruption issues, there's a lot of doubt among the youth that he will be able to deliver on these specific points. They're not sure if he's the right candidate for addressing these issues. That's why Obi was the preferred candidate, because they felt that he could really address these things in his campaign portfolio or manifesto, rather. He gave really clear-cut, decisive ways of how he was going to address these issues. Many youth believe that Obi would have been a preferred choice, and Tinubu might just continue this business-as-usual approach that Nigeria has seen for the past 8 years under the Buhari administration. But since 1999, when, you know, democracy as we see it now started in Nigeria, but also just since independence.
Well, interesting that, 15 people wanted that job because there is a lot that they would have to tackle. Idia, trust and turnout were big factors going into these elections. Was turnout as high as expected? I mean, what do we know on that front? And what, in your view, is the greatest lessons for Nigerians from this election cycle?
Okay. I think, the turnout has been the worst since 2003, when it has been declining. We have encountered 8% decline in turnout compared to the 35% in 2019. We currently had 27% turnout in these elections. And this is, of course, due to a lot of reasons. One, of course, is the insecurity pervading the country, coupled with the fear of political violence. The mismanagement of electoral logistics also impacted on the turnout, while the Naira scarcity, the fuel scarcity, created a form of despondence in the people. When you put it together, Nigerians just feel like maybe their vote will not matter. And with the way these elections have actually been mismanaged, and the fact that it is also along the ethnicity, the identity line in which the election was actually fought, will mean that if care is not taken in future elections, turnout might continue to decline.
Temi, as Idaya referenced earlier, of course, the Electoral Commission has said if you have a problem with the results, take your concerns to court. Now, of course, there is a time frame in which political parties can do that. Is that likely to happen, or are we likely to see something or more happening outside of the courtrooms on this?
So definitely things will be taken to the courtroom so that a judicial process can happen. That's how a healthy, functioning democracy works. You have checks and balances. So if there's an issue, you can address it in the court. Yesterday, while the results were still being collated, PDP and Labour both walked out and said they were no longer going to take part in the process because they felt that the election had been compromised. They had lost faith in the INEC chairman. So they were demanding that a fresh election happen under a new INEC chairman. So definitely things will happen in court to challenge the results because, as we can see, two of the parties involved didn't believe that this was a free, fair and safe or credible election.
Idaya, briefly, on top of tackling Nigeria's problems, the president-elect will now, of course, also have to unite the country. Is that possible given the tensions we see right now? What do you think we're likely to see in coming days?
I think in this next couple of days, the work of the president-elect is clearly caught, and that is to actually help in terms of fostering national unity. And this means inclusion. Inclusion in particular of young people, inclusion of all ethnicity, and how to balance the fear in a country where tickets are balanced along regional lines, the north, the south divide, and religious lines. To assuage the fears of Nigerians that Muslim-Muslim ticket, which is going to play out from May 29th, will be one that will not take the right of the almost 50% Christian population of this country. So national unity is actually paramount before we start talking in terms of tackling insecurity, tackling the economic challenges that we are currently battling with. And that will not be the job of one man. It will be the job of all the interest in this country, in the interest, ethnic, religious, and generational interest as well.
Idayat Hassan and Temi Ibirogba, thank you both for your time. I do appreciate it. Still ahead here on Straight Talk Africa. As Russia's war in Ukraine enters a second year, is war fatigue hitting some Western leaders and countries? My guest is Mark Malik Brown from the Open Society Foundations. He'll tell us what and who dominated discussions at the recent Munich Security Conference. We'll be right back.
In times of change, when the world seems uncertain, and what we hear doesn't reflect what we see, we seek the truth. When we are told only part of the story, we lose trust. In moments of crisis, our dreams, hopes, and wishes for a better tomorrow depend on a free press. At Voice of America, we bring you the stories that people take risks to see. We connect the world and unite it with truth. At Voice of America, we show you the whole picture.
Welcome back. Russia's war in Ukraine is in its second year, and there is growing concern in several countries about the long-term impact of the conflict. Are these signs of war fatigue? Well, the war and those worries dominated the recent Munich Security Conference. The annual summit in Germany attracts heads of state, top diplomats, prominent military figures, as well as leaders in business and civil society. Well, my guest this week is Mark Malloch Brown. He's the president of the Open Society Foundations. He also served as Deputy United Nations Secretary General under former UN Chief Kofi Annan. Malloch Brown was at the Munich meeting, and he spoke to me about the mood among those who attended. Mark, let's start with the recent Munich Security Conference, where Russia's war in Ukraine was, of course, front and center. What stood out to you in terms of what was discussed and what came out of this meeting?
Well, I think there was alarm, particularly in the corridors, less maybe in the public statements, about the state of the war, a feeling that it was at a bit of a pivot point where it was less about the successes till now of Ukraine in containing and reversing Russian advances, and it was more about who had the better supply chain for replenishing their weapons supplies, and a sense that both combatants had real vulnerabilities in those supply chains, that the West was a little too cautious and slow in replenishing the Ukrainians, and that the Russians were desperately searching markets such as Iran and China to see if they could secure more resupply for themselves. So, you know, a war which had been about a slog for territory has become, in this phase, a war about who can secure the best supply chains for rearming.
What do you think year two of this war will reveal to us about Vladimir Putin, what his thinking is, what his intentions are, and essentially what he sees as the end game in Ukraine?
Well, I'm not sure we'll learn much more. I think his stubbornness and the fact he's deep in a bunker of his own making is already pretty clear. But I don't think anybody should underestimate that stubbornness. He's going to, he sees it as strategic patience, and that not for the first time, Russia, as the Soviet Union before it, will see off its opponents by just being willing to fight longer and harder than the other side. And whether it was Napoleon's armies or Hitler's armies, Russian strategic patience and resilience is something people underestimate at their own risk. So I think, you know, he's not going to give in. And the difficulty for Ukraine, a much smaller country, is how they force him to the negotiating table to enter into a peace agreement that will stick. It's quite possible there might be some ceasefire agreement to allow the two sides to rearm, but it needs a much more stable, deeper peace agreement than that, and it's still hard to see the way to that, because Ukraine will want all its territory back. I think there's a question mark about the Crimea, but at the moment Ukraine's claims are that too. And on the Russian side, you know, they're not going to be satisfied without showing that this massive expenditure of Russian human life and economic capacity and the trashing of Russia's international reputation, that there was some reward for that. So you've got two sides with completely conflicting peace ambitions at this point, and that's always hard to try and make a peace when you have that disparity of objectives still. It's a dangerous moment. It's a dangerous moment with a lot of risk on both sides.
Indeed. Mark, the United States has accused Russia of committing war crimes in Ukraine, with U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris saying the perpetrators must be held to account. How does the West do that? I mean, beyond sanctions, how is Vladimir Putin going to be held to account?
Well, I think there is, and we at Open Society Foundations, we are giving financial support to a number of Ukrainian grantees who are documenting war crimes and bringing that documentation to relevant international judicial partners. But it is still quite difficult to see the exact route by which this goes. The International Criminal Court is making investigations. There's been a once-off UN investigatory team. And there is, of course, a call for a special court to look at the crime of aggression, which would be directed particularly at the leadership, in this case, President Putin, and the immediate circle around him. But, you know, I think the key point for everybody to recognize is that, you know, while often the prospects for accountability look bleak at the moment of deep conflict, when you've had this massive number of civilian casualties and the clear targeting of civilians by the Russian side, that, you know, sometimes the prospects for accountability can look at their bleakest at a moment like this. But the contemporary history is more often than not now there is subsequent accountability, often not perfect, but leaders who are behind these kinds of campaigns never walk freely again on the sort of Champs-Élysées or the streets of London or New York. They consign themselves to living in the shadows where international justice is not going to reach them. And you know, I think we're into that space now for President Putin. Any prospects he might have had of, you know, retiring to the south of France or to a villa he's purportedly built in Switzerland, you know, now lie smashed. In fact, I think his ability to even leave office and ensure that his life would be safe is probably now not possible. So, you know, the wheels of accountability can be slow and the path to justice often quite a complicated one. But I think that Kamala Harris chose to lead off her speech in Munich on this theme shows that, you know, Putin really is in the dock on this. He is facing a level of international opprobrium and international justice inquiry that he can never have anticipated when he began this a year ago.
China says it is deeply worried about the long-term impacts of this war. Are there countries in Europe, especially those part of the Western alliance, who are worried as well, who might succumb to war fatigue? I mean, does everyone hold a whatever it takes, as long as it takes view?
Well, look, there were plenty of countries at Munich which would share the Chinese concern. The Brazilian foreign minister talked of the need for a peace plan, and other very sensible, respectable countries like Brazil, you know, similarly, you know, are anxious to see this war brought to an end because they have an appropriate diplomatic concern that, you know, just escalation without end is rarely a happy solution in a situation of conflict. But I think within Europe, the lines hold pretty firm. There's, you know, there are obviously thin differences of opinion, but I think, you know, the most striking thing probably in Munich was to see the German Chancellor Scholz, you know, on the stage at Munich a year after Germany was still a country which, you know, really always put peace first, declaring and confirming that Germany would now exceed 2% of its GDP spent on military, that it would send those tanks that had been requested to Ukraine and was demanding others follow, and was unequivocal in painting Putin, you know, as a war criminal and an imperialist was the German fashioning of the argument. And so, you know, while you can point at countries which might over time wobble because of the economic consequences of this, I think ultimately people realize that the future of Europe and European security is on the line with this conflict, and they cannot afford to blink.
Mark, we've seen the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov paying multiple visits to the African continent. He's been warmly received in some quarters, and of course the Russians know that they do have sympathizers in significant parts of Africa. What is the unwillingness by much of the global south to back the Western alliance's stance on Ukraine say about geopolitics, and how worried is the West about what it's seeing in parts of the global south?
Well, look, as a very frequent visitor to Africa and somebody who, you know, has roots in the continent and, you know, a huge fascination and passion for it, you know, I have a lot of sympathy for those African countries which are wary of throwing their lot in with the West over Ukraine. First, I don't think there's any doubt that nearly every African country, with the exception of Eritrea, you know, recognizes that this was an illegitimate invasion, and that for Africa, where the sovereignty of borders is an absolutely key principle to stability and peace on the continent, that you know, the behaviors of Russia by this invasion has breached the number one rule as far as Africa is concerned. So that's not really the issue that's in doubt. What's in question is the way that the West has allowed the Ukraine conflict to consume all the diplomatic oxygen, all the economic assistance available, or a huge portion of it, and to not leave enough to address issues in Africa. And you know, there has been a war during this period in Ethiopia, the Tigrayan conflict, which, you know, as, I mean, there are debates about life loss estimates, but it seems probably Ethiopia has so far lost more lives than the Ukraine conflict when you take in, you know, civilian deaths from starvation and public health issues. And you know, it's been an equally brutal conflict, and it's had very little attention. Now, there is, you know, and this is blamed on double standards. In truth, there are very significant geopolitical strategic differences that I think also explain the difference of attention. But I do understand the frustration of so many in Africa that that conflict is largely overlooked, whereas the conflict in Ukraine consumes this huge attention. But beyond that, you know, Africa is in the grip of what's been called the polycrisis, debt crises in countries like Zambia and Ghana, and prospectively many other countries as well. And, you know, issues of fuel price, food prices, the reordering of supply chains in a way that is disrupting economic production in industrial production in many parts of Africa. You know, given all this, the lack of, you know, real attention and commitment is key. And, you know, they look forward to an issue like climate, which is a problem not of their making, but where the impact is felt heavily in Africa now. And they wonder, you know, where's the Western leadership on that? You know, where's the carrying through on the pledge of $100 billion a year of climate finance, and let's get that up to the trillions? You know, they see sort of mealy-mouthed efforts to squeeze a bit more out of the World Bank or the African Development Bank, but they don't see the same kind of concerted leadership to address that agenda that they see to address Ukraine. If the West showed that response, some of what they find distasteful, and I would cite, for example, you know, it was impossible in Munich not to hear a lot of complaints about South Africa's military exercises with the Russians. You know, I'm sure it was considered an easy way to pull the West's nose, but you know, it went down like a lead balloon in Munich. But I think the onus is on the West to show it's a good, reliable friend and to discourage South Africa or others reaching out for fair weather friends who don't have the same economic means to provide support, and who instead are just into the provision of some very dangerous security support through the Wagner Group and its ilk. So, you know, I think this is a time to really, for the West really to get on top of an Africa strategy, which is one of partnership with Africa, one appropriate for today, not the past, and to put the resource behind it.
And that was Mark Malloch Brown, president of the Open Society Foundations, speaking to me there from New York. And that is it for us this week. Thank you to my guests and to you for joining us on television, radio, and online. And please remember to follow us on social media. I will see you next time. Until then, goodbye.